Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. Coming up in just a bit, we'll head to Salisbury University to meet some young inventors working to transform the way we get around. But first, we'll talk with Devin, Dustin, and Danielle Wall, who tried to make history last month as the first trio of siblings to swim across the English Channel. Only 1,400 people have successfully crossed the 21-mile passage since 1875, due in part to the rough conditions on the water. The Wall siblings used the race to raise money for Alzheimer's research, a cause that is important to them because their grandparents suffered from the disease. Devin and Danielle successfully completed the swim while Dustin encountered severe cramping and sickness and had to stop the swim while in French waters. The Wall siblings are back stateside now, and they join us by phone. Devin, Danielle, and Dustin Wall, welcome to Coastal Connection.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Devin, let's start with you. Let's talk a little bit about the challenges unique to the English Channel. People that know about it know that it's some of the most difficult currents in the world, and it's 21 miles across. I mean, beyond that, what are some of the other unique challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main challenges of the English Channel is simply that it's the English Channel. It's considered the Mount Everest of swimming. It's extremely cold, and swimmers are often suffer with hypothermia as well. The water's very cold. Cramps, sickness, and jellyfish stings were also a big problem for me as well.
I've heard about many different ways and different types of ideas to raise money for a cause. Why did you guys come up with this one?
Well, I think that we really wanted to make a statement, and we wanted to try something that a lot of people thought was probably nearly impossible. Alzheimer's is something that's very, you know, near and dear to our heart. So sometimes, you know, you have to do something really, really big in order to make a statement. And that's what we were trying to do by crossing the English Channel.
So at its narrowest point, it's 21 miles across the English Channel. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the currents are so strong that it's never really a straight shot. Danielle, tell me about how you sort of map out your strategy of how you're going to make this, sometime 10-hour swim.
I don't know if there's really a strategy. None of us actually swam 21 miles, probably upwards of 25. And there's a pretty strong current the last mile up into the French shore. So if possible, you have to try and save a little bit of energy for that last mile in order to get into the French shore. But aside from that, that's really the only piece of strategy that's really involved in the swim. Just make sure that you have enough energy that last mile to get into the shore of France.
So how do you train for something like this? I mean, this isn't just something where you go to a pool, I would imagine, and just swim laps until you feel strong enough. Or is that exactly how you start training for swimming the English Channel?
There's a little bit of pool swimming involved for sure. But training in Colorado, it's different because we don't have the ocean. So we would try and find a bunch of lakes to swim in around Colorado. Or we would get used to the cold water. We would swim in the pool for the day and then ice bath at night. And then also weight training's involved. So 2 to 3 times a week with the weights.
Devin, same question to you. Talk about what you did. I understand you spent some time swimming in the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did long swims in the Chesapeake Bay, got up to 5 hours in there. And one of my main concerns was acclimatizing my body to the cold water. So what I would do was I took ice baths 3 days a week for 30 minutes, just fill up the bathtub with cold water, dump in ice, and sit in it.
Wow. What was the harder thing for you, building up the endurance for your body to, you know, swim and do the strokes? Or was it, you know, harder to build up the endurance to survive the cold?
I think it was probably the endurance to actually do the swim. Once you hit about 8 to 9 hours of swimming, that's when you really, really start hurting. And a lot of it really is not only building up endurance in the pool, but also kind of that mentality.
I read that you guys swam about 10,000 meters a day, 5 days a week. How long were you guys doing this rigorous training schedule?
It was about, 10,000 meters a week, a day, 50,000, 60,000 meters a week. And that just consisted of a morning and afternoon practice to get the yards in. You know, you'd have a morning 5,000 meters, afternoon 5,000 meters, along with lifting and ice diving. To train for something like this, it's usually a year to 2 years. I was at school for some time, so when I came home for the summer, I had 3 months before I swam the channel. So I really stepped up my training. Almost it was a job in my head, and I would go in every morning and go in every evening to really train hard.
Devin, I'm interested, you know, the fact that you did all these long swims in the Chesapeake Bay. Once you got into the English Channel and you were making the swim, how did the conditions in the English Channel compare to the Chesapeake Bay?
The conditions in the English Channel are definitely more choppy, a lot more waves. The water was a lot colder because I really didn't have many opportunities to swim in the bay when the water was really cold. So definitely more choppy. The water was colder, and there's not as many jellyfish in the Chesapeake. So that was also a challenge.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington. I'm your host, Brian Russo. We're speaking with Devin, Dustin, and Daniel Wall. They're three siblings who attempted to swim across the English Channel last month. I've read that, you know, in other people's accounts of swimming across the English Channel, that, you know, you get 10, 15, 20 miles in, and sometimes, you know, it's common to get disoriented or sick, you know, kind of similarly to people who are running a marathon. They hit, you know, that wall where they don't think they can go anymore and they're not really sure where they are. Did any of you experience this sort of disorientation, and how did you overcome it?
I think all of us experienced it at some point. I think it's common for an endurance athlete during an event like this to experience something similar to that. And, you know, when you're doing a big endurance race like this, obviously you're going to hit a wall at some point in the race. I think that's just to be expected. And if you're just kind of able to push through that wall, it normally gets better after that. But a lot of people get out because they aren't able to push through that wall. But if you could just hang on an extra 1 or 2 hours to push through it, then, you know, I think you'll be good for the rest of the race.
Now, Devin, you and Danielle finished the swim. Dustin, unfortunately, you didn't. I wonder why that happened. As you look back in hindsight on your swim, what do you think happened or what did happen to stop your quest to swim across?
It's really difficult to explain, but you're kind of like in a me state, as bad as that sounds. And I stopped for 15 minutes before I had to get out, because I didn't want to quit, and I was 6.5 hours in, 14 miles in, and just psychologically, I knew I had 10 miles to go, and I was cramping, and I was sick, and you really start hurting, and it just kind of had to end that way. I'm pretty disappointed about it, but in the end, we did raise $20,000 for Alzheimer's, and it was a learning experience. So
yeah, Dustin, I know that some people will be listening to this conversation and wondering, you know, the fact that you didn't finish, you know, who picked you up? I mean, was there a boat that was traveling for safety reasons, you know, just behind you all when you were swimming?
Yes, each swimmer had their own safety boat that you would the swimmer would swim next to the boat. The boat has, you know, the captain, the co-captain. All of them are, you know, CPR certified, and there's an official on the boat to make sure you complete the swim, and that official certifies the swim. So, yeah, you swim next to a boat, and you have crew on the boat to provide support, usually consists of family members. I had a boat, Danielle had a boat, and Devin had a boat, just to provide support and feed you and keep you moving, so.
What did it feel like, Devin and Danielle, to finish and to reach the end of something that you trained so vigorously for, you know, almost a year? Devin, let's start with you.
Yeah, for me to finish, it was one of the greatest feelings I've ever had. I've done Ironman triathlons before where when you finish, and they're probably pretty physically the same. However, the English Channel was by far the hardest mental challenge I've ever done. But when I finally stood on shore in France, it was at 10 o'clock p.m., so it was dark. No one could see me. It was only me. That's it. And I was extremely proud, extremely relieved, and just so happy. I raised my arms up, even though no one could see me. I was extremely happy.
Danielle, how about for you?
Yeah, same thing. It's always a nice feeling when you finish something that's so physically challenging. Just a mixture of relief that it's over and relief that you made it. And then relief knowing that you can just relax now. And so it's a really good feeling. It really is. But for me, it's a little anticlimactic as well. But they, as Devin mentioned, there's no one there. You're just there by yourself. And like Devin mentioned, we both finished around 10 p.m. at night. So it's dark. No one sees you. And there's no one there to, like, you know, say good job or anything. But it's good. It's a good relief, and it's proudness within yourself. So
yeah. Well, I mean, at the end of all of this, you guys raised, you know, as Dustin said a minute ago, almost $20,000 for Alzheimer's research. And all of this started because, you know, your grandparents are affected by this disease. You know, tell me how this money that you raised has helped your family.
The money we raised goes directly to the Alzheimer's Association,
mm-hmm.
To research, to care, and to support. And not only that, but I think that we also raised a lot of awareness for Alzheimer's disease. I think that if you ask a lot of the younger population in the United States, you know, what exactly is Alzheimer's disease? They might not have an idea of what it is. They might have heard of it, but they might not know exactly what it is. So we're all young. I'm 24, Danielle's 21, and my brother's 19. So we thought that by doing this swim, we could say, hey, young people are involved in this. Young people are doing this swim. We're doing something that a lot of people would think of as impossible, and we're doing this for something we're really passionate about. So we also hope to raise a lot of awareness for Alzheimer's disease, and that awareness goes directly to research. Alzheimer's disease is one of the lowest funded diseases as far as research goes in this country. So even though so many people are affected by it, that's what we really hoped to do was the awareness as well. So we hoped we did played at least a small part in that.
We've been speaking with Devin, Dustin, and Danielle Wall, three siblings who swam across the English Channel last month. You can learn about their swim across the English Channel at our website, wamucoast.org. Devin, Dustin, Danielle, thank you so much and all the best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. We'll end today's show on the campus of Salisbury University, which is still several weeks away from the start of the fall semester. But three undergraduates have been using the summer lull to work on a big project, a bike powered by the sun's rays. Julie Alderman explains.
Catherine Murphy, Samuel Brown, and May Palace are spending their summer inside a lab at SU's Hansen Science Building.
It was in February. We sat and we said, you know, what do you want to do this summer? Like, we want to do research. And, you know, we were talking and we talked about, you know, renewable energy, this and that, and I forget who, but one of us was like, what about a solar-powered bike? Yeah, let's do that. That's awesome. And then, you know, we started looking into it, and everything fell together.
Solar-powered cars have been around for a while. Even if they have yet to hit the mainstream, solar-powered bikes are just starting to take off, with prototypes in development in different corners of the globe. Murphy, Palace, and Brown think college students are a natural target group for this sort of technology.
And we thought, you know, how many of my friends commute on bicycles? Like, a lot of them. A lot of people who live off campus will bike.
The bike can run completely on a motor or on a combination of the motor and the rider's pedaling. For the former, you simply flip a switch and let the electric power do all of the work. You can also pedal a bit and put the electric power on different levels of assistance. The motor is powered by solar panels, which posed a challenge for the group.
It was all trying to figure out how we were going to connect the solar panels and how we were going to, you know, put the solar panels on the bike or near the bike, how we were actually planning on charging the bike with the solar panels. Originally, we wanted to do a design where the solar panels were directly on the bike.
But that wasn't very convenient. So they put the panels in one of those carriers you attach to the back of your bike to tote around small children. Brown says despite that load to tote around, solar bikes have an edge over other kinds of electric bikes.
You don't need a power supply like a house or outlet to recharge the bike.
It might sound pretty straightforward, but when you look at this bike, it's not hard to tell that a lot of sweat went into its creation.
Basically, just imagine the main frame of a bike. On the back, above the rear wheel, we have a battery mounted.
The battery fits in a bag attached to the back seat.
The battery weighs about 20 pounds, so we had to build extra supports to kind of hold that weight, I guess. Under where you would say you would sit, where the rider would be, there's a control panel.
The control panel is like the brains behind the operation.
It controls where the power goes, because the power has to be sent to an LCD display, which is in between the handlebars, so it's right there for you to see.
The handlebars look normal enough for an electric bike, with a throttle and brakes.
The brakes, because the brakes also cut off the power to the bike as well as brake the bike.
The bike itself looks kind of like a mess, tangled in wires. But it works.
And the big thing on the front wheel, we have our motor. It's a pretty big thing. It looks pretty cool. It's basically just a black box right now when you're looking at it. It's pretty neat. It's pretty cool looking. It's good. I like it.
The group says the energy the bike creates with its solar panels can save a person who rides 5 miles a day up to $500 a year on energy costs, compared with the cost of a normal electric bike. Pala says she hopes this use of alternative energy gets other people thinking about how they can be more environmentally conscious in their everyday lives.
I think our goal is to get people interested in doing projects like this that do improve your carbon footprint and things like that. We want people to look at this and say, hey, I could do that.
Pala and Murphy were already interested in renewable energy before the project began. Brown took a hands-on interest when the panels finally arrived.
I remember being a kid, and I remember the day I discovered scotch tape. I'm like, I can take two things, and I can put this tape on it, and I can make another thing. So I was like, that's so cool to me. I got that same feeling when these solar panels came in, that you can set them up in the window, put a voltmeter attached, you see exactly how much power is coming from them, and then put your arm in front of it and block the sun to see the number plummet.
The solar bike is being funded in part by a grant from the National Science Foundation for $1,000.
So basically, we wrote about an 8-page proposal where we, set out, this is what we want to do, this is why, this is exactly how we're going to do it, this is our budget. We submitted it to a committee from Salisbury University who then reviewed it, and they used money that we have been granted from the NSF.
The group says their bike is not on its way to being mass-produced anytime soon, at least as long as the price of solar panels remains high. Brown says that the group hopes to fine-tune the bike and research ways to bring down the costs.
If we kind of figure out what the essential parts are for it, we can at least bring the cost down so it would be more feasible for somebody to actually go out and buy this. Not as much that we're really looking to mass produce it, but to let our research and the data we found improve maybe other people doing this or solar, at least like raise awareness for solar panels in general.
As Brown, Murphy, and Pallas reach the finish line on this project, they're looking forward to showing it off and riding it around campus in the fall. I'm Julie Alderman.
Bicycle. You can see what that solar-powered bike looks like for yourself. We have a photo on our website, wamucoast.org. I'm Brian Russo, and you're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington.